Okay, my name is Billy Fiatta, and I've been doing a series on stories and self. And today we're going to talk about stories of place, places we have lived and what difference it might have made in our lives. Earlier in the week, done stories of family stories that have been passed down to us from parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, you name it. The kind of family stories that are part of our heritage and part of who we are also as a person, because we incorporate many of those stories into who we are. Also, stories of oneself. We talked about it in terms of strands or threads that have some continuity in our lives, like your work life or faith life, health, relationships, picking out a thread from this tapestry that is our life and giving it particular meaning and significance by following it through from your earliest recollection to where you are now. And the purpose really is to honor one's stories, to acknowledge that our life is a series of stories. We have inherited them, we create them, we continue to create them every day. We share stories with others. And in the process of doing that, we create more of our own identity, who we are as persons. So today we'll focus on stories about place. And in our mobile society, we do an awful lot of moving around. Although there's still some people, I have a friend in the near Northfield area where I come from, Northfield, Minnesota, who lives in a small town that the farthest away she has been is Duluth, Minnesota. And she's 50 years old. That's hard to think about. There aren't too many people like that I know of, but maybe you know of some that are. That have stayed in a particular place all their life. But many of us, and probably most of us here, have done a lot of moving around, either by choice or we've been moved to someplace. So in that process of moving, we have to develop a whole new system of roots again. Because when we're in a place, we put down deep roots. If you're there for any length of time, even if you're there for a short time, you have to establish some network of roots. The grocery store you go to, the church you belong to, the schools, finding a barber or a hairdresser, a doctor, dentist, all of these become very important in our system, root system, in a place that we belong to. And when we are uprooted and go to a new place, we have to start all over again to establish those kind of roots in order to feel like we can function effectively, or sometimes even survive. And the deeper roots that we establish in the places that we live, roots like family, perhaps living close by, special friends that think and have the same value systems as we do, that are very important in our lives, our church community, schools, an economic life in a community, the deeper kind of roots that are very important in our lives. Again, have to be reestablished in some way. So there's a lot of loss in this dislocation of moving from one place to another, at the same time that there's anticipation of something new and interesting and something that's drawing you to another place. In my experience as a psychotherapist in the counseling center at St. Olaf College for 11 years, I dealt with this issue with many students who had experienced loss and dislocation, some of them many, many times over, so they had a sense of lack of trust in the places they moved to, difficulty in making new friends because they were always making friends and leaving them. And that's very hard, I think, for a child to do, even though we often see them doing this quite naturally. There is some sense of loss there that needs to be dealt with. Holden is sort of a place between places for many people. It's a special place where many of us come at various times of dislocation in our lives to find connection, to find support, and to be nurtured. And as we all know, to keep returning to this place because it has something special here for persons. So place. The book that I've been referring to several times this week is Kathleen Norris, Dakota. Mm-hmm. Many of you have probably read that. She has a new book out, The Cloister Walk. Have you read that one, anybody? Mm-hmm. About the time she spent with a group of I think it's Roman Catholic sisters in a cloister. She moved from a very nurturing, supportive place in New York where she was a writer with an artist community, a lot of different support within that community, back to Lemon, South Dakota. Or North Dakota it is, isn't it?
South Dakota.
I always get that fixed up, okay. South Dakota. You've been there. and you know all about this, you don't have to read it. Huh? It's wonderful the way she talks about moving back into this place, which is the roots that she had earlier. She's coming back to a place she knew, but discovering it in some new ways too. And it's not always easy to move back into a place where you have been, but you have become somewhat different moving out of there. I like what she talks about the wind in South Dakota. And how she likens it to an ocean. Hadn't thought about that before, and I'll read you a couple excerpts from that. What makes the Western Plains seem most like the ocean to me is not great sweeps of land cut into swells and hollows, or the grass rippling like waves, or the sheets of rain that one sees moving in the distance like storms at sea. It is the sound. In the open country, far from any trees, the wind beats against you, as insistent as the ocean current. You tire from walking against it, just as you would from swimming against an undertow. Interesting comparison. She says there's no escape. The Western Dakotas are the windiest region in the lower 48 states. Wind yanks moisture out of the ground, turning wet fields to dust in a matter of hours. It robs farmers of valuable crops at harvest, blowing them away with the dust of the combine. It encircles us, much as water encircles an island, increasing our sense of isolation. The wind is what drove many homesteaders off the land. It drove some of them mad. for me, walking in a hard Dakota wind can be like staring at the ocean, humbled before its immensity. She talks about having a sense of being home on the planet. My blood so like the sea in chemical composition, my every cell partaking of air. I live about as far from the sea as is possible in North America, yet I walk in a turbulent ocean. Maybe that child was right when he told me that the world is upside down here, and this is where angels drown. Life is, she talks about life being lived on the human side in South Dakota. They know, Dakotans know why they are living here. And yet, at the same time, she's lamenting the increase and pursuit of tourism that is going on in this area now, and what it might do to the soul of the place. So when you read a description like that about a sense of place, how does that shape a person to live in that particular place? What kind of shape did it give to her life living in New York as a writer? And how is this shaping her, continuing to shape her as a writer in South Dakota? The Native Americans have a very profound sense of place. When you read some of their writings and learn more about the rituals, the sense of sacred places that they have. And when I think about the dislocation that they experienced having to move to reservations and not only leaving the areas where they lived and put down roots, but their sacred places they had to leave behind. And what did that do to them? And when I thought about place, I also thought about our two-legged and four-legged creatures and our winged creatures that we share this earth with. And the sense of place, the migration of animals and birds. When we drove through Nebraska last March, and along the Platte River, the sandhill cranes, I had never seen so many in my life. They were just all over near the Platte River, and the sky was full of them coming in, landing on the waters around there. All of them heading north to a place that they knew and were moving back to for the summer. So the sense of place that these creatures have in returning. We have a family of robins that found a finch's nest in the bend of a water spout, and they embellished it a bit and took it over. But they came back to the yard, and instead of finding their own, they found another. But they came coming back again to a particular place. And one of the favorites that of our family are the loons. It's also a poem that Mary Oliver has written about. The loon on Oakhead Pond cries for 3 days in the gray mist, cries for the north it hopes to find, plunges and comes up with a slapping pickerel, blinks its red eye, cries again. You come every afternoon and wait to hear it. You sit a long time, quiet under the thick pines in the silence that follows, as though it were your own twilight, as though it were your own vanishing song. We have a special place up in the North Woods of Minnesota, on a large lake on a 1.5-acre island that is the place which is most like home for us, and we return there every summer, just like the loons return to that same lake every summer. It is both a place to enjoy the beauties of nature, as well as a community of friends, as well as solitude. And it's a kind of spiritual place for our family. In fact, when a few years ago, about 6-7 years ago, we finally got electricity and a telephone, which we hadn't had for several years, and our daughter was a bit unhappy about this because it was going to change the place. And she left us a big note that said, "Remember, this is not a summer place, it's a way of life." So places in our lives. And that makes me think about home. How do you define home? Does a place, a particular place, home for you? Or is home more abstract? Does it lodge in an experience or a person? When you come to a place and find a particular person, that there's home? And then I think about the story of the prodigal son. Do we have to go away from home before we can return home and know what is there? There's lots of different ways of thinking about place and home, if the two are synonymous, or are they different, or... So what I really want to do today is to get you involved in telling your stories to each other about place and a particular place or a particular place or idea or someplace that is home for you, what that means in your life. And maybe this has changed. Maybe it continues to change. Or maybe there's only one particular idea or place that you gravitate to as being significant. Or maybe you want to talk about the whole progression from what has happened, moving from one place to another. So we're going to leave it wide open for you to make a choice on this. And then we'd like to divide up into... how many do we have today? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Good. Let's have 4 groups of 3. And if you came with somebody, try to find another group so that we mix this up a little bit more. But before we start, I'd like to start with just relaxing a little bit, and instead of just cognitively grabbing a place, we're going to do a little relaxation and just being in your own space and taking a couple deep breaths, letting them go. Okay, then let's...
I really felt badly for her. So I invited her to participate anyway, and she did through the whole week, and I hope that she had some stories by the time that she left. No, that's a good point. I thought there was a wealth of stories there if she could just get in touch with them. So let's talk a little bit about what was this like for you?
Fun.
Fun. What kind of stories did found you?
The basic geography that I grew up with.
Okay.
And that kind of geography, the north. I grew up in the northeastern corner of South Dakota, and it's different than West River.
Mm-hmm.
But I've traveled the state quite a bit, and I had a 5-minute conversation with Kathleen Norris.
Oh, you did? Oh.
And I said, I know those places. I said, do you know where Ralph, South Dakota is? And she said, yes, I know exactly where it is. And it's a high prairie country. You know, it's got about five buildings in it. I think there are five trees. And my mother homesteaded out near there, Meadow, South Dakota. And that's that kind of geography has just basically shaped me.
How has it shaped you?
Well, I like open country. Okay. My wife and I have taken some train trips recently, and one of the trips was from Chicago up to D.C. and from D.C. down to New Orleans. And I suppose the last 300 miles going into New Orleans, you got these trees as high as they are here. And you can't see anything, and it just drove me nuts. And we've taken the train from Grand Forks, North Dakota, out through North Dakota, Montana. That's country. That is country. You can see forever.
Yeah. How do you like it here, Roy?
Well, I've thought a lot about this place. I mean, I love the community of people here. Dorothy and I have talked about spending a year here, and I think for the sake of the community, that would, you know, that would be great. I'm uncertain about the geography. I hesitate on that.
I think there are lots of people from the plains that really feel claustrophobic here and you know, say so pretty much right off. And yet, I always feel like it's really lovely.
Yeah, but you grew up with buildings around you, didn't you?
I grew up with mountains around me.
Buildings.
See, buildings, I've talked with a lot of people about what we're talking about right now.
Yeah.
And, Karen, we? No, not Karen.
Karen, yeah.
No, there were two we's in Northfield.
Yeah. Maury and Christine Carlson.
Christine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Christine said she grew up in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, lived in an apartment house. I could hear people above me, below me, on all sides. And I felt safety. And I said, what? How could you feel safe in that kind of geography? I said, you know. And I think, well, clearly, I mean, if you grow up in the mountains, this place is not a problem.
Yeah.
If you grow up in West River, South Dakota, this place is a problem.
But you know what I hear? Are we supposed to be talking?
Yes.
Yes. But our friend Martha here said something. So I hear two things that Martha opened my mind to was that what we're saying about place, and you said something about how was it for you, and of course I say fun, and then he says something more high-minded, which is geography, and I'm saying what? And so geography is an important part of place and how you feel, but Martha said, people, did I hear you say, Martha? Remember?
Yeah,
that people...
That it's not entirely.
What was it?
That it's not entirely where you are, but it's also partly who you're with.
There, that's it.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The people in the and that's what you're saying about Holden, the community here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any surprises on what place found you? No?
Well, in our group, one of us expressed a sense of loss when they went from one place to another.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, I had moved around quite a bit. Whole smorgasbord of community types and to some extent cultures within the U.S. And I've never felt any great sense of loss when I've gone somewhere else, rather than more coupled with a sense of excitement something new. And I quickly established touchstones which remain, and so I can go back not expecting things not to have changed. Because you can't go home, and you can experiment with that. But
those touchstones have become a connection for you.
Yeah, and those touchstones mean people, relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the place itself, a lake, for instance, a marsh and a lake that I canoed in, and learn to appreciate certain things like that.
So there wasn't the same sense of loss as somebody else was talking about.
And I've never had any constraints on pulling up and moving on to the next place.
Mm-hmm.
Some people would call it G-feet.
Anybody else have that experience? Or had the experience of loss?
You said some people call it GP.
Did anybody have any radical shifts, like from a very rural to urban, or urban to rural, or?
Well, I think for me, it's the amazement of finding the long-term home in a place that I thought life was impossible, and that was in Southern California. And I've been there for 28 years, and had this experience of being sure that we were called to go back to the Midwest, and flying in over the desert and into LA, and all of a sudden realizing, my God, it's home, you know, even breathing the air. It was, so it was that kind of surprise that home would be where we thought we'd be there very short period of time.
Hmm. That's a different kind, yes. So you have made it home in the sense of even in a place where you wouldn't have chosen to
very
make.
Phony there, you know. All the nuts roll to the furthest corner.
And lots
right
of
there.
Freeways and automobiles and pollution.
Lots of chances to connect.
But you do have an ocean there.
Right.
Is that the boundary?
What?
The ocean is at the boundary.
What about the whole concept of home? You said it felt like you were coming home when you came there.
And that was after we had been there, and we're in the midst of this certainty that we were being called back to the Midwest, that there were all these people longing for us to bring our children back.
To return home. To the Midwest.
And then being surprised by finding no home was where we've been.
Did anybody find home as not being in a particular place? But Jay?
Yeah, because I've been back to all the places I've lived and gone in the homes, and they are not homes, you know. So for me, home is, you know, where I am, where God is. Because God is wherever, you know, God. So that's the only place I can trust as being, you know, not transient, not
So it's not connected with any specific place. It's where you are.
And
where?
Where God is. Because God is where people are.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What other thoughts? What did other people discover in their journey to place?
I didn't so much discover it just in the circle, but I recounted in our group an experience I had on the way out here this year. Between Indiana and here, I got to go through the tiny little place where I was born and lived the first years of my life in West Central Wyoming, where my father was assigned his first parish. And it's literally in the middle of nowhere. Now there are 44 people there, then there were 17.
It's growing.
It's cool. But to get to it, I drove the route that I haven't been there in many years, but my parents once showed me how they had driven there. And so I drove that route with my children to get there. And you drive through this desolate place, nothing but sagebrush for miles and miles and miles. And then you come over this rise and here's this tiny little irrigated place. And I knew my parents were both city kids. And I realized, it's going to make me emotional. Yeah. Here's a couple of 22 and a 24-year-old from St. Louis going out there in the wilderness, and they must have thought, my God, where have they sent us? What is this? You know, and I suddenly had this weird sense of compassion for my parents when they were children. They must have cried a lot.
So it really opened up a whole new appreciation for them in this place. So you're seeing them in this place.
Yeah.
Who made the connection?
Yeah. I remember going back to the small town where I grew up and lived there for 16 years, and none of my family lived there anymore, and the railroad tracks were so important. There weren't many trains coming through anymore, but I remember as a child loving to hear the sound of the trains coming in and sometimes going up there and watching the trains. And so I stood there and a train came through, and it was like being back as a child watching that and thought about what the meaning that had for me. Hadn't anticipated that. So going back to a place which is not a place I've called home for a long time, but it had that particular image for me. Then.
Well, for me, it's still, Dorothy and I went back to, and Dorothy and I and a couple of friends, Chuck and Jane Solberg, we went back last August to my growing up place in South Dakota, and there are a lot of people around there that are still there, including my Clara and Peter Olson. And Clara was my grade school teacher at Norway School Number 3, Norway Township, Country School Number 3. And we spent a morning with her, and that was just, boy, that was great, because had that conversation with her. Covered all the kids, you know. We talked about all the kids that where they were, what kind of student I was.
So you really got in touch with some of these
And the farm, you know, the farm where I grew up, there's not one stick of wood there. All the buildings are gone, and the trees have been removed. And I guess if I would have owned that land, I probably would have removed the buildings also. But I would have left a couple lines of trees there for the wildlife. But it was good to go back. You know, mm-hmm. Sloughs mm-hmm. were still where the sloughs were when mm-hmm. I was a kid, and mm-hmm. creek was there, and that was my creek.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like your sense of place is really tied into to a particular area. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just recently heard Kathleen Norris speak in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. She was there with the Friends of the Library mm-hmm. in our new downtown. And she had an interesting, I think it was a bit manufactured, but I'm not absolutely sure, because the way she got into talking about differences of place was that she was introduced by one of her, not a classmate, but an underclassmate, a fellow student that was there part of the same time that she was at, is it Bennington, and it's in the East Coast someplace, where, is it New York, or is it New Jersey?
Bennington, Vermont.
Okay, so that's where she went to college during the 60s, where, you know, even this was a wild place, and she was pretty tame until her senior year, she said. But what was interesting is this person came out to introduce her, and Kathleen was nowhere to be seen. So this woman comes out, and she looks like a very sophisticated New York, and she identifies herself as a Jewish author, and mm-hmm. you know, and maybe she looked like a lawyer, and she was absolutely wonderfully dressed and very expensively dressed with beautiful hair and all, and makeup and everything else. And she comes out and she introduces Kathleen Norris by saying, in small towns, your manner of dress is not costume, and it's not identification. It's much more practical than that. And so Kathleen comes out and she has on what looks like those old flour sack prints, you know, it was sort of a faded cotton house dress, and Chinese, you know, those Chinese slippers with a strap over it, mm-hmm. and white boggy socks, no stockings. and she sort of just hauls her briefcase out and dumps it on the thing and starts talking about it. It was just hilarious, because the woman that I was with was a Midwesterner, and she said, well, that isn't true. When Midwesterners go to town, they dress up. It was really wonderful. That's so funny, but that was kind of the way she played off against mm-hmm. her schooling, where she went to school, and where she was at that point, and talking about how the people, even in the monasteries, underneath their robes that they use for worship service, had on jeans and boots and so forth. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a very interesting way into a funny audience in L.A. that came, some of them from church dressed up, and others of them, you know, in jeans.
Jeans, right. Well, we have a son coming home to Northfield after 5 years of being at home in the South Bronx. And I think he's at this point ready for some change, and it's going to be interesting to hear about. We know something, we visited him there and also we have talked with him, but the South Bronx has been a very difficult in many ways, and with a lot of things going on there, that a lot of violence, a lot of brutality, and as well as people living their lives there. So, okay, I think we better stop for today, and tomorrow we're going to talk about the last in the series, and it's going to be stories of, it's called The Flood of Compassion. Another staff person, Heather Tweet, was there as a volunteer. She was a first-year medical student in Grand Forks. Going to talk about the Red River Valley floods. And I also was there with the Red Cross as a mental health disaster team and did some volunteer work, so we're going to have some stories about flood and about the compassion, the outpouring of compassion of people. But I'd like to leave you with a poem. I usually like to leave people with a poem. It's one of Mary Oliver's poems. Many of you know her poetry. She uses nature themes a lot, but it also says a lot about human life. This is called Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things.